It's time to experience the Synergy Connection Show with your host, Lucy Forsting.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Synergy Connection Show. I have as my guest this morning, Jim Lee, and he's a fourth generation Floridian. Before we get started, however, I always remind everybody that if you miss this show live, it is an archived show on SynergyConnectionRadio.com. And you can go there for all of the shows that have ever been on Synergy Connection Radio. There's about 8 pages of them at this point. And on that landing page for Synergy Connection Radio, you will see a Boomer, B-O-O-M-E-R, box. And the Boomer box will take you directly to their website. Because we are all in this together, as they say, with the coronavirus, one of the things I want to remind people is that your nutrition is your foundation for your health. And I've been talking about this for the last year and a half now, is that it's so important to maintain your physical health, because if you don't have that, it's extremely difficult to connect the dots to the emotional, spiritual, and mental part of who you are. So please check that box, sign up for their newsletter, and maybe go explore their website, because there you're going to find the foundational elements for maintaining a very good physical body, especially as we face the coronavirus. All right, so back to Jim. He was raised on a ranch as a child. I know he and I've talked about riding horses and all the things that he did in the back roads of Florida. He also worked with the Tampa Tribune for 27 years. He's written for magazines like the Florida Sportsman and Saltwater Sportsman. Recently, he just released his newest book, which is called Palmetto Sunrise, and you can get that on Amazon. And it's a story about his family, multi-generational family. I've read it. It's a delightful book. I think it would make a tremendous Netflix series. We've talked about that as well. I think it'd be fun to see it come to life that way. But today we're going to talk about how to write a book, what it takes to, I guess, create maybe a bestseller, or at least a book that is going to hold somebody's interest, and where you need to come from as a writer in order to make that happen. And Jim brought a magazine with him today called Writer's Digest, and I remember taking it years ago, and I have not read it in quite a few years at this point. But Jim still gets the magazine, and in getting this magazine, in the issue that was, what, January, February?
Yes.
Okay, so at that point, he read an article in there that really is the foundation for what we're going to talk about today. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Writer's Digest is, everybody ought to have it that writes or wants to write. You should, because there's always something you can get out of each publication. And this one, the Writer's Digest story that we're going to talk about is was an article by Gene Valetti Bowerman. And Gene did just a wonderful job of this, and normally I wouldn't pay any attention to this, but this is an article for screenwriters, actually. And it's called Take Two, and so I got so much out of it, I felt like it's really worth knowing about,
and especially as it relates to then writing something. I know with a screenwriter, I mean, if you don't get hooked in the first couple of minutes of a movie, I move on, you know, if it doesn't hold my attention. And I think Dan Brown writes that way personally. You know, his books have become movies, but there's a cadence, there's a rhythm to the way he writes that absolutely holds your attention. So I'm guessing that this article kind of focuses on that, you know, that if you're going to write about something, you need to write about something that is going to hold the reader's attention as much as like a Netflix movie. It's got to grab them, hook them in.
Well, that's true. The hook is universal. Uh-huh. But before you write the first page, you have to remember that writing is a business. And most of us a lot of people don't write that way. They write for what they want to say. They got a story to tell. They've got to right a wrong. They got a romance to finish, a lover to chill, or your beloved character-driven story.
Mm-hmm.
And all that is fine. But you got to remember that unless you want other people to read it other than your family, there's
right.
some things you have to do.
Right.
And basically, there's a concept. I call it a driven concept that the book will fall into. And if you don't have a driven concept, the book economically will fail. And you gotta. There are many driven concepts, and I'm going to give you some illustrations.
Okay, well, before you give the illustrations, let's go back for a second to your book that you just finished.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the driven concept in that book? You know, if you wrote it as a business, then maybe share where you were coming from as you wrote the book. Because in part, you wrote the book because it told the story of your family, but that wouldn't be a driven concept, I'm guessing.
Well, honestly, I have to admit that I don't have as good a driven concept as I could have had I known this at that time.
Well, how would you have changed it?
Well, because it does have one in the background, okay? We've got the antagonist in the background through the whole movie, and getting rid of him or getting over him was actually the concept. You know, the bad guy, you only get the bad guy, okay?
Okay, so he is floating around in the back
right,
of the story.
But I would have done it a little differently had I known more.
Okay, okay? How would you have done it differently?
Well, I would have made him probably more...
More of a bad guy?
No, up front. I would have probably had him sooner in the book.
Okay.
Okay, my book is actually two parts. It's my great-grandfather and then my grandfather. And it's a book of fiction, but my grandfather left me a sheaf of papers about the early days and what he did and what his father did and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I based the book on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, since I wasn't there, I had to make up the lines and whatnot. But other than that, all of the real things that are in the book, all the details and the anecdotal stuff is real.
Mm-hmm.
It happened.
So where does the antagonist emerge in your book?
It's about a third of the way through it.
And what's happening then?
Well, see, my great-grandfather and grandmother and a friend of theirs migrated from Alligator Town, which is now Lake City, to the Kissimmee River Valley, or to Kissimmee. It wasn't even Kissimmee. Wasn't named that when they got there. But at any rate, and their idea was they're going to go down there and there's cattle running wild throughout the woods that they were going to collect and start a cattle business. And it didn't work out exactly that way. They did some of that, but they also made their money gathering up other people's cattle and moving them over to the West Coast, to Tampa area, to the meat processor. Plant.
Do we still have a processing plant there now? I don't think we do.
I don't know the answer to that. It was there for years, but at any rate, that's what he did. But along the way, things happen. And in their, to answer your question, in their travels by ox cart and horseback, they ran into highwaymen or, you know, holdup men, and then they followed these people. And they found out that they were in this little store just outside of Kissimmee. And so they went up and they confronted them. And there was an episode there where the bad guy died. But his son never forgave him. And his son was the antagonist through the rest of the book.
So he was going to right the wrong,
well,
so to speak.
He was just—he was not raised right, and he just went wrong. You know, he went back as—he made his living doing things for other people that weren't right, and the book explains that pretty good. You know, and so he would turn up every now and then, and he'd either have somebody. For an example, he hired these two guys to burn down my great grandfather's barn. And maybe the house, and maybe kill everybody in it. We don't know because my grandmother stopped him with a bullet.
Hmm.
And so it gets exciting in several places, okay? And it was fun to write. It really was.
Oh, well, I know it was a good book. It was a good, to me, I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it.
Well, so, you know, you got to remember, though, that writing is a business again. And here's the driven concepts for an example. Here's some examples. Jaws. What would you think the example would be there? To kill the shark.
Well, it would be to kill the shark, yep. But it was also to save all of the, you know, the kids that were out
true.
There. I mean, there were other things just...
Well, to kill the shark was the main one, though.
Yeah.
Okay? And to keep the beach open, of course, was another one.
Right. It was a financial...
But then there's Die Hard, and you had to get the bad guys before they got out of the building for whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Ocean's 11, you got to steal the money. And then why did Ocean's 12 really kind of fail?
Why?
Because Ocean's 12, it didn't diverse. It was the same thing, only worse. It was more complicated, and it wasn't as good a movie. It wasn't as good a story. So the lesson here is that your story has to have the concept of its own. It has to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be something different about it.
Repetition doesn't sell.
Yeah, exactly. And Star Wars, for an example, each had a driven concept. Now, an example of the one was to destroy the Death Star.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to have some target, so to speak, in mind. And but this raises the question, what is not a driven concept? A driven concept is not a high budget, okay? It doesn't have to be a high budget movie in this case, and it's not car crashes and explosions. Those can be in your movies, but that's not going to make the movie or the book.
Those are the ones that with the Academy Awards are receiving special effects.
Yeah.
So
right,
and we've had a lot of movies, I would say, in the last few years that have not been story driven. They've
mm-hmm.
been special effects driven.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also not difficult to explain. It has to be easy to explain. Your driven concept has to be easy to explain.
Well, why don't you explain a little more about that?
Well, it has mass audience appeal. That's one.
All right. So what are some examples of things that have mass audience appeal that you've seen or you've read?
Well, any hit movie has mass audience appeal.
No, not necessarily.
Good movie.
Yeah, but some box office movies.
There's more to it, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's only, mass audience appeal is part of the driven concept. It has to have a clear goal. Most anything can happen, but the goal remains, okay? It's has a high degree of conflict and obstacles. That's part of... What?
I think we need to explain a little bit more about these because you're kind
sure.
of going through a list.
Okay.
And people are not grasping where you're coming from because
okay.
you're just kind of going down, you know, I understand what you're saying, but at this particular point, let's expand,
okay.
you know, these a little bit rather than just notch them off.
Well, let's start with the audience appeal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You target your book at where the people you want to read it. Okay, in my case, I targeted it to people who like history, nonfiction, fiction, history, and also people in the state of Florida.
All right, so how did you arrive there? And I'm going to make you expand on this because, again, I think that people that are writers, whether it's going to be for a Netflix kind of a situation or just a book at Barnes & Noble. How do you know how many Floridians, for instance, are even reading books?
Well, exactly. You have to go to some of the media and that'll help you. In other words, on Facebook, there is a group of people who are Floridians. And they banning all kind of things around. And
but do you know the numbers on something?
No,
like
I don't.
That?
No, I don't know the numbers. You see, my book actually was my target was too small for economics. It was too small.
So that.
But
would
I did it. But I didn't write the book to make money on, and that was my. I wrote it for other reasons. Okay.
But that kind of goes against the very first
thing you said, because it's a business. You should.
Right.
See, I missed the boat because I just found this article and I didn't realize that I should do that. And it's hard to do that when your book is contained in a small area in one state and it's not about other things that would appeal to other people. Okay, but my book is a little different. If you want to make money on a book, you've got to follow these other rules.
All right, so we're going to get to the other rules in a minute, you know, because the show is an hour show, so we don't want to go and all of a sudden be at the end of this without having expanded some of the points. So as we look at a writer that's at home, you know, has maybe a box of historical notes, as you did, from a grandparent or a great-grandparent, or maybe they've just always been interested in some aspect of life. It could be nature, could be photography, it could be spelunking, you know, going into caves, it could be you've written a cookbook.
I did that.
But, I mean, it's going to be something that has held their interest, you know, for years and years. So now they're kind of sitting there, and maybe it's because we're having to sequester in our homes, basically, at this point because of this coronavirus. So now that box that's sitting in the closet is calling to them, saying, hey, you've got a couple of minutes. You can't go to the mall. You can't go do this and
that. It's a good time to start your book.
From a business perspective, as they pull that box out of the closet, just from the business perspective, they need to be looking at all those notes, not so much as an archive of their family, but what would make this a book that a lot of people would want to go and pick up and read?
Exactly. Mass appeal.
Mass appeal. Yeah, yeah. So how, you know, I mean, let's use your cookbook. You know, your cookbook was out how many years ago?
It was out in 2008.
Okay. So, I mean, you've always loved to cook. You had a restaurant. You still love to cook.
Yep.
And what I loved about your cookbook, by the way, and I've not seen this with any other cookbook, is there's a really neat little story with each recipe.
Yeah, and it was apropos in most cases to the recipe, too.
Right.
Either where it was done or how it was done or whatever.
Right. And that appealed to me because I've got, well, at one point I had hundreds of cookbooks. Because I do like to cook, but now I've narrowed it down to maybe 60.
I've got a bookcase full of cookbooks.
Yeah, and then some. So what I loved about yours was that not only are they really good recipes, but it was just fun to read the background of that particular, you know, recipe, if you will. So I guess one of the things is that you loved cooking, and you loved traveling around the state. And most of these are from the state of Florida.
Most, yeah. I got out as far as New Orleans and Jacksonville to New Orleans and the rest of Florida. Yeah.
In Florida. So, I mean, you had a love of your historical knowledge of the state of Florida that goes back those four generations.
Well, I fished almost everywhere that you can normally fish in the state of Florida, all around the state.
And I should say that this is a seafood cookbook, Legends.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, again, for somebody maybe that is thinking about writing a book, from a business perspective, that cookbook actually did have the right focus.
Yeah, it did.
Because people cook, people like to fish.
And no matter where they live, a percentage of them will eat fish.
Right. And it doesn't, it doesn't make any difference. We have vacationers that come down to the state of Florida, a lot of them to fish, especially in the Keys.
Oh, yeah.
But they like to come down here and fish. Mm-hmm. And so they can take a cookbook home with them, not only as a memory of their vacation, but also because they want to prepare maybe some of the fish that they froze, you know, sent home. And so that to me, I mean, you could sell a cookbook like that from a business perspective at any airport in the state of Florida or any gift shop that is a souvenir shop for somebody that's
going to go home. That's actually how I marketed the book, through gift shops.
Through gift shops?
Yeah, it worked real well.
Okay. So the business end of that one was a given, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the person that wants to write about family, like you did, they have to think more outside of that box.
Yeah, that's a little harder because at least you can have a story for an example, and bear in mind it's fiction, so you could add into it a mystery. Mysteries appeal to a lot of people. And
okay.
If it's a part of it is a mystery and it's kind of woven into the end of the story, that might work.
Wasn't there a Western writer, because I don't read a lot outside of my interest, but wasn't his name Dane Gray or something?
Oh,
like
Zane,
that?
Gray.
Zane Gray. I think I remember my dad reading a lot of his books. And didn't he weave a mystery into the Western?
Oh, yeah. And by the way, as an aside, Zane Grey also, there's a bar down in the Keys named Zane Grey Bar. Because
for him?
He stayed in the Keys a good bit, because I understand it.
Like Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah. And he was a great writer.
So if somebody was looking at, again, your style of book, then weaving the mystery in and out of the chapters of a family history would work in terms of capturing an audience.
See, I did that with my antagonist, but I did it too late in the book to make it universal.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so because I didn't really understand the concept of driven concept. I didn't understand that.
Mm-hmm. You drive the interest almost from the first page.
Yeah.
Someplace.
Yeah.
You have to.
First chapter, anyway.
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would.
Yeah. How would you do it a little differently this time? Just as a pretend? Because you can always come out. My book, by the way, everybody, March the 22nd, it was available on Amazon as a second edition. So you can do a second edition of Palmetto Sunrise and bring that hook in right at the very beginning.
I'm thinking about that, seriously.
Okay.
Yeah, because I love the book because of, I mean, to me, it's been over about 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I outlined it about 20 or 30 years ago.
Right.
And finally, one day I thought, you know, I wanted my son to know what his background is. And so I thought, you know, if I don't write this book, it's never going to get written. So I sat down, and within a year, I had it done.
Mm-hmm.
And but I had it all outlined before then. And that's the way I worked. Each chapter stood on its own, which goes into a whole nother realm of writing, because you have to know a lot of the tools and such as tropes, okay? And you have to, when you either have one big trope or a trope every...
How are you spelling that?
T-R-O-P-E.
Okay, and what is the definition of a trope?
Well, a trope is let's see if I can remember exactly. It's a beginning and an ending in a short period of time. It's my version of the, okay. In other words, you start a chapter and you have an event.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then by the end of the chapter, you solve that event. Or you can have the event at the beginning of the book and solve it at the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And which is what my book did.
Yeah. So you can. Mine did every chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it either way.
I think with
but
Dan.
But you should look up tropes. You should look it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so those of you that are listening that are newbie writers, maybe you haven't heard that expression before, T-R-O-P-E. So look that up. I know that with Dan Brown's book, every single one of his books, the chapters are about 8 to 12 pages. So somebody who's reading it, you know, keeps that rhythm going for those 8 to 12 pages. And what happens in his books, as far as I'm concerned, is at the end of the chapter, you have to start the next chapter to see what's happening next, because the tension is always, always building. And then usually in the last two chapters of his books, he's wrapping up all of those loose ends so that you can see how they fit. It's like a major patchwork quilt. And so you see all these little pieces throughout his book. And then the last two or three chapters maybe they're putting the quilt together, and you get that, aha, now I understand.
And by the way, all tropes are not good. There are good tropes and bad tropes.
And bad ones.
Yeah, because it all has to weave into the book smoothly.
Which is a skill, I'm sure.
Yeah. But back to concepts, okay? Another thing, other than mass audience appeal, it has to have a clear goal.
Okay, so explain a clear goal.
Well, the clear goal is to get the bad guy, catch him, whatever.
What if it doesn't have a bad guy?
It's
a different kind of a book.
Okay, if it doesn't, well...
What if it's a historical book and somebody's just reading for the sake of understanding Native Americans, you know, in the Navajos or...
Well, now you're talking about a nonfiction book. That's a different animal.
Okay, so what we want to say is that tropes are more for not nonfiction, they're for fictional books.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's several different kinds of books that people might write.
Mm-hmm.
Your cookbook did not have tropes in it. It was a recipe book that gave
you
the background or not?
Actually, some of them were.
Oh, okay.
Because this little story, it's a one-page story, it's a short story, short story. And it had a beginning and an end, usually.
Okay.
So
tell the one about the alligator.
Oh, well, that's also in my second book because it is an event that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a true event. I applied it to my grandfather.
Okay.
And basically, it's this: we're walking down early in the morning. We're trying to go to our deer stands. Okay. And we have this area that we were in is on the west coast, and it was heavily wooded. And there was a lot of big hogs and deer in this area. So we were headed to our stands, and there was four of us. And we had four stands once you get through the thick stuff into the edge near the coast, near the Gulf. And so we're walking along, and there's something on the path up ahead. And I said, it's a gator. And so I thought the gator would feel us coming, you know, our vibrations, and jump off into the stream, but he didn't do that. So I walked up to him. I was in first in line. I had my shotgun in my hand, in my right hand, and I just tapped him on the nose, thinking that he would jump.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did jump. He grabbed my shotgun. In a wink of an eye, he had my shotgun.
Oh, wow.
And I'm pulling, and he's pulling, and the guys are running the other way saying, shoot him, Jim, shoot him. I said, I can't shoot him. He's got my shotgun.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
And so then, because the gun is smooth, it went between his teeth, you know, and came out, and he flipped into the creek.
Which is good, because he could flip towards you.
Yeah, I flipped into the creek. And so that was an interesting thing. And so there are alligators also in my other book, and as a matter of fact, one of the bad guys ran into one.
Hmm.
But... that story was a true story, but it's really kind of unique, you know, so I used it twice.
Did you keep that gun?
Oh, I still have the gun. Yeah.
Did it leave any marks?
No, it didn't. And
isn't that interesting?
It really interesting. I thought that might dent it, you know, but it really didn't. He just snapped it and grabbed it and didn't, I guess he didn't. See, here's the thing. When an alligator feels something near his mouth, he'll grab it, thinking it's a fish or a turtle or something, and he'll grab it. And that's what he did. It was instinct. And so he didn't understand the fact that it wasn't soft.
Well, not only that, it had no flavor at the time.
That's right.
So
well,
I'm sure he was more willing to let that one go. So having a clear goal is, if the writer is starting a book, and, you know, again, they're sitting with maybe notes or ideas. Or I have folders in my desk area. And so I have different concepts that I want to work on down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I see a saying or every time I see an article, it goes into the folder. And so, you know, the book I've talked to you about, Emmanuel the Christmas Dragon, you know, that one has a folder. The next series and Miss Twiggs has a folder. And so I'm constantly aware of ideas, and they just, you know, go into these folders.
That's a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to do it, because you don't sit down and a book comes to you. And you, and that's why I outline, because once I outline and I get all my outline in, then I can sit down and write the book.
Right.
And so, but in an outline, you got a beginning and an end.
Right.
And that's what a goal is the end. What's the goal? What's the purpose of this book or story or real? What's the purpose? And if it is to acquire a girlfriend or a boyfriend or to find the bad guy or whatever it is, you got to have a goal.
Yep, I can see that. So the goal should be obvious, I would guess, at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Build through the middle of the book and then resolve at the
end
of the book.
See, in a historical novel, you have to move it along with the times.
Right. Well, Victoria was a... did you ever watch that on PBS?
I can't remember. I think I did.
Well, it was extremely well done. It was over several seasons. And it was a documentary, though, but it was a story about Queen Victoria. And, of course, she was...
No, I didn't see that.
She, you know, started her ruling when she was, I think, 19. She was very young. And she lived, you know, and ruled for 70-some-odd years and had all these children and... so when they based the documentary, it had a beginning. It had, you know, the birth of her first children. It had a middle part, and of course her husband dies. And it's her continued ruling of the country, England. But it's a very interesting series, and much like Downton Abbey, which I know that there's a lot of listeners that watch Downton Abbey. I was certainly one, but I couldn't wait until it started every January. And then, of course, you'd have a series of maybe 10 or 12, and then it would be over. And then you'd have to wait again until the next year.
We got a new one like that.
What's that?
Started a year or two ago, Yellowstone. Yellowstone is is a great story for TV. I mean, it really is.
And it's a Western, isn't
it? Well, it's a modern Western. This guy, he has a big ranch, and everybody wants it, and
why does everybody want it, by the way?
Well, because it's next to Indian reservation, they want it, and the tourist people, they want it.
For what reason?
To make money.
I know, but I mean, just are they going to leave it as a ranch, or are they?
No. The Indians would love to have it as part of their territory.
Their land,
yeah,
right.
But woven into this thing is the real estate guy, okay? And he wants it. And
to build homes on?
They'll write him out, I think, if they haven't done so already. But it's a struggle for the rancher to keep his ranch, is what it is. That's the goal, is to keep the ranch.
Okay, so in that particular story... then the beginning of it is we have a dilemma, and that we have multiple people who want his land.
And that's problem, brought out right away.
Then the problem is, how does he keep it?
And this new series is going to be more exciting. I think I saw the previews. I can't wait.
What makes it more exciting?
Well, his daughter is a drunkard, okay, but she handles all the money.
She is drunk?
Oh, she's a drunkard.
Okay.
And she handles all the money. She drinks a lot.
Okay.
But she's smart, very smart. And that's just a neat twist in the movie.
Now, is this Netflix or?
No, it's a series on television.
I know, but what station? In case somebody wants to
find it. I don't know if I can tell you. I don't remember. No, I can't. But it's going to start pretty soon, probably, I think, either the latter part of this month or next month.
And it's called Yellowstone.
Yeah. It's all over TV.
Okay.
They do a blurb now on it now. So.
To draw your interest.
Okay. Get you ready for it.
Yeah. So that would be your next point, I guess, which is the high degree of conflict and obstacles.
Yeah.
You know, because we were saying that his obstacle is, how does he hold on to his land? And then the conflict is everybody else who wants it.
Yeah, and there's gunplay, and there's kidnapping. There's all kinds of things that goes on in this Yellowstone that was really, really good. I mean, a lot of conflict. Everyone, there is a conflict that emerges, and then they sort of end it in the end. Okay.
So I have a thought right now for writers that are good writers that are out there. I'll bet that there are at least 100 or more writers that are doing something with the coronavirus. Because it would be, because I mean, you know, the intrigue, you know, did it start in China because it was a germ warfare got loose?
What intrigues me is that all of a sudden this thing was worldwide.
Yes, instantly.
Instantly. That reeks of something not particularly good.
It does. It does. And I think there's a fair number of conspiracy kind of theories that are out there. But I mean, can't you just imagine it used to be in the old days, typewriters flying, writing the script. And now, you know, of course, it's going to be keyboards with computers. But the whole premise of how did this, you know, it was quiet. They didn't announce much in the way when it first got started in China.
Boom.
And then part of what I heard, and you've probably heard this too, is that from Hunan, where the province, Milan in Italy, the story goes, is that that is one of the fashion capitals of the world. And they had workers from this area in China that went there to help with the garments. They went home for the Chinese New Year. They contracted the virus at that point, came back to Italy, and because there were so many people in Italy, because of the way, I mean, they smoke more there.
That's a good story,
but
I'm not sure I buy it.
Yeah, but I mean, again, somebody someplace is creating.
It's going to make a great book.
It would make, an awesome movie. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome movie.
See it. Someone will do it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, will it be on television first? Probably. But then they're going to create with great movie stars, you know, this.
I bet the screenwriter group, there's a group of screenwriters here in St. Petersburg, by the way.
Uh-huh.
I bet the screenwriters are on to that.
Oh, I would be. Oh, my gosh. I would be like just delving into all of the possibilities, which then goes into this conflict and obstacles.
Yeah.
You know, the obstacles that we now are facing 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I are not 6 feet apart, but if we were smart, I guess we would be. But I mean, making sure that you stay safe, you stay healthy, you do the things that you need to do to keep your chances of contact to a bare bones minimum.
Yep.
It's really fascinating how things are evolving.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Which leads me to something else.
Mm-hmm.
The book has to be original. In other words, by original, there's only so many basic stories out there.
Okay? That's true.
Okay, but it has to have an original twist to it.
Right.
Go back to, what was it, 11, what did we just say a while ago? Back to, Ocean's 11.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ocean's 12 was the same thing.
Right, and you don't want to have...
And 13 is even worse.
Right. Well, even the Star Wars, that was one of the criticisms that came from that, is how do you keep making major twists? I mean, they had a moneymaker, and they can talk about the Solo stories, or the Princess Leia stories, or the Luke Skywalker stories, but in reality, you can only expand those so far.
Yeah, I think they've gone about as far as they can go.
I think so.
But I loved them all.
And yet everybody's waiting for the new Avatar.
At least one time. Yeah.
I mean, we can't wait for Avatar to come out.
Avatar was a unique movie.
It was.
And books need to be unique
and
some description, you know.
And then you've got universal themes, you know, so, you know, good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's been out there forever.
Love, hate, escape, family, power, justice, honesty.
Remember Dallas, the series?
Oh, yeah.
And that was definitely power. Holy cow.
I actually went out to Dallas farm or ranch where they had it there. When I was in the insurance business, they had a big shindig out there, and I went. And I learned that Dallas is one of the cleanest towns I've ever seen. And it's also, when the sun goes down, the heat doesn't stop. Dallas. Yeah. But I loved the ranch. It was really neat. And they had a big auditorium there where we were, had horses on the stage even.
Oh, wow.
It was great. Yeah. Wow. Dallas was quite a conflicting story there that went for a long time. Where the oil is the background.
Right. And I'm just thinking different parts of the country also have those themes. Like, I went to Memphis, Tennessee a couple of years ago with friends. And we, you know, that whole area is about the blues. And so you've got the music.
Yeah.
You've got the, you know, Elvis Presley, of course, being there. But it is more of a blues musical environment than it is almost anything else. New Orleans has a theme.
Yep.
New York City has a theme. Hollywood has a theme. And so we pick different parts of the United States and we look at what that theme is. And for Florida, the theme is kind of a, it's like a stew to me because it depends on what part of the state you're in. If you're a little further north like Jacksonville, that has one theme. If you're down in the Keys, it's certainly something else.
Yep.
If you're up in like Gainesville or Apalachicola, I mean, it's
which,
all different.
Which comes to the setting of your book. You need to be very, very specific about the setting of your book.
And have knowledge
and,
of
yeah, you
got
to have knowledge of where it is. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you go back to the old thing that you got to know what you're writing about.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That never goes away.
Right. But, and if somebody wanted to write about, you know, the culture of oysters and the families of, like, Apalachicola, you know, expanding on the fact that hurricanes took place there, they still do.
And you could have the good oyster guy and the bad oyster guy. Yeah.
Exactly.
Just
you
like
could.
They did in Tarpon Springs. They, they had the Seven Mile Reef was the name of it, and it was a conflict of the Tarpon Springs sponge divers and the Florida, the Keys. Sponge divers was one of the big overall conflict there.
Interesting.
It was a neat movie. It's an old movie, but it was on the recently, and I got to see part of it. But
That is very, very interesting. So having those universal themes, and then having an appeal. You know, the appeal has to not be too narrow. It can't just be to fishermen, or it can't just be to fashion designers, or it can't be just to chefs.
And you can do that with conflict. Mm-hmm. The appeal can be conflict of something that they're interested, you know, that'll have to anybody's interest.
Mm-hmm.
So if your setting is in New York City, and if it's a police setting, it's easy to put a conflict in there. You know, or if it's in California, that's a whole different ballgame out there right now, with so many illegals out there. That would make a great story, really.
Well, and especially if they had somebody rise from the depths of despair in all of what's going on in California. You and I, you know, end up talking to people quite a bit that are from all over the United States. And I have heard literal horror stories coming out of California in particular. It's a large state. And, you know, from San Francisco down to San Diego, we have a lot of difficulties, you know, coming from literally poverty-type conditions. And my parents lived in the Los Angeles area many years ago, and there was a homeless park that was right along Ocean Boulevard. And so my son was young at the time, and we used to go feed the pigeons. We'd take bread, and he loved to see all the pigeons flying in. So we would go over there, and it was pretty safe. I never worried much about, I would never take him in today's world, you know, over there.
Yeah, we're in a different era.
Right. But they would bring, they had, even then, they had different churches that would take the park on different days. And they would bring in sandwiches and soup, you know, things like that. So they would show up about 4 p.m. And these people that were homeless lived in literally like kind of cliff areas. Yeah, they were right underneath the park. So you could walk down. Sometimes you would have to get off of like steps and walk along very narrow paths. And if they had a lot of rain, there was always the danger that these areas would slide down onto Pacific Coast Highway because that was right below them. So it was pretty scary, but they would come out at like 3:30 waiting for the trucks to pull up. And when that would happen, then they would be able to get at least one meal a day free from these churches. And so, you know, that's another kind of a conflict that could make a good story.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody there that would do something wonderful, who knows?
Or the bad guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who rise up out of that group to do things for them,
yep,
for their own group.
Yep.
It could make a good
story.
I
mean, it could make a good story.
Yeah. Let's talk about time limits.
Mm-hmm.
Time limits, really, the bomb is going to go off if you don't find it, you know, or
right,
things like that.
Right.
That's a time limit.
The building's
limit.
Going.
Yeah.
You and I watched Skyscraper with
your wife.
And for those who haven't watched that movie, it's really good. But not only is the bomb going to go off, but there's a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to figure out how are you going to rescue everybody in a very short period of time. And that movie kept me sitting on the edge of my seat.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, the time limit, is the building going to fall?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Is everybody going to die?
Yeah, yeah. And right now, we could do the same thing with the coronavirus.
Yes, we could.
We could set a time limit of when it's going to reach its apex.
Right. And they're saying this particular week that we're in, you know, is looking not so good.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep talking about flattening the curve because at that point we have fewer and fewer cases.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's not continually rising.
It's not coming as quick as we think.
Yes.
Or
yeah,
we thought it would.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. And I just heard today on the news that there's 189 airplanes scheduled into Florida from New York today.
And that's where the virus is the worst.
Yeah. So why are they doing this? You know, why not? Airlines are trying to keep business up, and that's not the thing to do right now.
Do you know that you and I have a mutual friend who was saying that from Minneapolis into Fort Myers, Florida, $38 one way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if there was ever a time for people to come to Florida from Minneapolis,
wow, yeah,
it would be now. And so they're driving traffic, you know, onto the airlines. And yet the airlines, I would not want to be on an airplane right now.
Well, you know what? Every time I've ever gotten on an airplane for long, you know, in the last few years, I got a cold from the people. Because the air is not new. You're breathing everybody's air.
Uh-huh.
And so because it's pressurized. And so I've gone to one of those, I forget the name of it.
Airborne.
Airborne, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I got a spray, and I put it on my finger and put it in my nose.
Mm-hmm.
When I do that, I don't catch a cold. As a matter of fact, I'm doing that now.
Mm-hmm.
I have it in now.
Okay.
Because you breathe in germs, you know, and
mm-hmm.
at least it'll kill some of them, maybe.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm trying to protect myself as best I can.
So these time-driven limits, you know, that you know here is the issue and you have this long to resolve it.
Yeah.
And that keeps the tension.
Well, remember the airplane that landed in the middle of an ice-covered river up north?
Uh-huh.
It's a true story.
Uh-huh.
That was a great time limit thing because they had to get people out.
Right, exactly.
And before it sank.
Right.
And there's a lot of easy ones there. For an example, by the way, your driven concept, it contains a clear, concise log line. Now, what that is, it's explainable in a few words, and such as blue water. That one was about educated sharks. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Liar, liar. A lot of people saw that one. Star Wars, Jaws, they all have a concept right in the title. So, you know, and it should have a short, suggestive title, too.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Well,
intriguing,
thinking,
you know, like Liar, Liar, Jaws, and Home Alone, and
right,
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Castaway, The Fugitive, Jurassic Park.
I'm thinking of one that I love that came out recently.
Yeah.
I know you didn't see it, but A Dog's Purpose.
A Dog's Purpose.
Yeah, and so in that one, you know, there is a purpose, according to the author, you know, and the person who created the movie, because it was a book first.
Uh-huh.
The Art of Racing in the Rain is about a dog. It's told from a dog's perspective. But it's something that has a beginning with a puppy. And, you know, they, you know, grow up ideally. And they live however many years. And then they come back. And a dog's purpose, you know, is always telling the story from, you know, the next time that they come back into your life. What is their purpose then?
Interesting.
So it's a very sweet, kind of a tearjerker, but it's a very sweet movie.
Huh, neat. Well, I know one thing. Learning what I learned from the magazine made a big difference in how I will write my next book. And had I not had Writer's Digest, I might not have ever seen this book. Or, and what it is it's a perspective from movies, and they're not that far-fetched from books. So in movies, these things have to happen.
Well, otherwise, it's all edited out on the floor, and they don't have a movie.
And so the book is the same way. The book is the same way.
Look at the number of probably screenwriters that do grade, I'm going to say C movies, that you and I would never pay even a dollar to go see. Certainly there's a bunch of them on television. Because
that's where they go now. It used to be a B-movie, you know, we called it. But now it's a television.
And some of them are so bad.
Yeah.
And you kind of wonder, you know, well, how are those people even making a living putting together a movie that is that poor? I look, you know, on a regular basis, I look to see what new movies are coming out. And I would say the majority of them are people that I would never recognize, number one. But again, it's the kind of movie I wouldn't go see.
You know the phrase, a star is born? Well, the stars are not born anymore. They use all different people. They don't make stars.
That's true. I mean, if Clint Eastwood was just coming on board now, look at all of the amazing movies that he's done, not only as an actor, but now as
a
director.
Well, also, I just think, there's less talent out there working now, because it exhibits itself on television in the lousy movie or in the movie house.
Right.
You know, now once in a while you get one that's worthwhile. But what was that one we saw about England and the Prime Minister?
Winston Churchill's movie, Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour.
That was amazing.
Yeah, that was great. And, of course, you know what that theme was. It was the war, how he got to be where he was at.
Yeah, the King's Speech was also another one that was based upon his speech impediment. And, you know, how he had to overcome that as they moved into World War II, because, I mean, there was no choice. He had to be able to give important information and be able to speak, you know. And so there's a lot of very, in fact, I think for me, I find that I am most interested in either something that is very sweet, like A Dog's Purpose or The Art of Racing in the Rain, or one that is historically driven, you know, like The King's Speech, or there's a lot of good ones that have history behind them.
Well, writing a book is a wonderful thing if you do it right. And if you're writing a book just for your own amusement, that's fine, okay? But if you're going to write a book, you got to remember it's a business.
Right.
If you want anybody else to read it.
If you do want anybody else
to read it. And there's a lot more rules. These were just the beginning rules, the things you do before you sit down to write and figure out, okay? Then the rules of writing actually are part two, you know?
Right. And for those that are not good spellers, maybe your sentence structure isn't the best in the world, you know, there are these people that are called editors. And so you can come along with the basic premise of a book and then let the editor, you know, fine-tune it for you. So it doesn't mean that you have to be a jack-of-all-trades. And some people have wonderful ideas, but they just don't have very good composition backgrounds, let's put it that way.
That's right. That's exactly right. And had I not used an editor, it wouldn't have been printable. So editors, and you can, and editors are not that expensive. You know, they do cost just like anything else, which is maybe we'll get into starting getting the cost of a book in a minute, in a little while. But but you know, how do you end a story? That's another one. The end to do is a hard thing, really. Endings are hard. They're hard to write, hard to hear. If you love the story and you want it to go on forever, how do you end it? You know, it always has to have an end.
Well, even in the one that, you know, mine is now, like I said, out on Amazon. It just came up on March 22nd. But, you know, the title of mine is The Adventures, as a plural, of Miss Twiggs and Company. And so the implication there is that it is a series, and there, it will be a three-book series in all likelihood, because I don't think anything should go on forever. But having said that, you have to end it in such a way as it leaves the person knowing that there is going to be a future story, and that the characters in the story are going to be shown again. And of course, that's what J.K. Rowling did with all of the Harry Potters. She had very clear characters that reappeared, for the most part, throughout each one of her books. And those, the kids became identified with those characters, you know, the Harry Potters of the world that are out there. And if you go to Universal, into Harry Potter world, I mean, you see hundreds of these kids with their capes on. You know, they image of being a sorcerer, of being able to conjure things up, of having magic wands and being able to do magical things with them. All of that is in the imagination of the child's mind. And so I think even a person who is reading a book about, you know, intrigue or history, you're appealing to that child inside of that adult mind that is still wanting to go on adventures, that's wanting to see it through the eyes of the author, that kind of says, wow, you know, look at that, you know, whatever it is. Look at that alligator, look at that.
How did you end your book?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, the lesson that the mice always, and it's Mortimer, Penelope, and Miss Twiggs, but that trio, their lesson is always about, you know, being hopeful that the future is not all doom and gloom, because this is set right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It's about love. It's about understanding the universal concept that we are all in the world to express love to one another.
And you said that how?
At the very end of the book, they're getting ready to leave on the train, and Brian, who's the little boy in the book, has learned from them that our thoughts create our reality, and if the reality is based in love, then that's the reality you will see. You know, whatever that expression of love is.
Oh, I love it. That's terrific.
Yeah. And so that's how
they leave. I can't wait to get my copy of the book.
You are going to get your copy of the book. It just literally came out. So the Amazon is only shipping, I guess, those things that are absolute necessities right now.
Yeah.
But I'm ordering some from the printer.
Right. Well, I ended my book very abruptly, and the antagonist invaded the home of my great-grandfather and grandmother. And my grandfather realized that someone else was there, and he had a gift for his father, which was a gun. And so the ending involves the gun, the antagonist, and his mother and father. And it ends abruptly, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. All right, well, we're going to close for today. This hour goes extremely fast, and nobody ever understands how. I mean, as we start the show, it's always like, holy cow, how am I going to talk for an hour? And as it is, we are already done. But Jim, you'll be back, and we'll continue talking about how to write and how to create a book that people are going to run into the bookstore and demand that the store carry.
Because writing is more than rules.
It is a lot more than rules. It definitely is. So I hope everyone had a wonderful Saturday, or going to have a great Saturday. and you know that you'll share this with other potential writers or people who are creative and want to know how to treat book writing as a business and as an art. And in the meantime, please go out there and make this your very best day. Thanks so much, people. See you next week.
Boomers Forever Young is really making a name for themselves as an exciting nutritional company with products that really work. People from all over the country are starting to take notice. Their whole person approach to health and wellness, combined with their unique array of powerful natural health products, are setting them apart from all the other companies in the nutrition industry. Their customers love the one-on-one free consultations and the results they experience. Sound a little too good to be true? Then go online to boomerboost.com today and sign up for a free consultation with a product specialist, or just give us a call at 1-800-861-4609. Again, that's boomerboost.com, or call 1-800-861-4609 to join the thousands already experiencing the benefits of Boomers Forever Young products.